Cool shadows pooling on the rainforest floor. A rat-like creature digs for tender roots. Its descendants will tame fire, invent the wheel, discover mathematics, create poetry, reroute rivers, level forests, build cities, explore deep space. For now, the only important business is finding food and staying alive long enough to make more rat-like creatures. Annihilated in fire and dust, the world is reborn in a hungry rodent digging in the dirt. The clock ticks. Nervously, the creature sniffs the warm, moist air. The metronomic beat of the clock speeds up, and I rise toward the surface. When I emerge from the dust, the creature has transformed. It's sitting in a chair beside my bed, wearing a pair of jeans stiff with dirt and a torn t-shirt. Stoop-shouldered, unshaven, hollow-eyed inventor of the wheel, inheritor, caretaker, prodigal. My father. The beep-beep of the monitor. The dripping IV and the stiff sheets and the hard pillow and the lines snaking from my arms. And the man sitting beside the bed, sallow and sweaty, covered with grime, restless, nervously plucking at his shirt, bloodshot eyes and wet, swollen lips.
Marika.
I close my eyes. It's not him. It's the drug Vosh pumped into you. Again.
Marika.
Shut up. You're not real.
Marika, there's something I want to tell you. Something you should know.
I don't understand why you're doing this to me, I say to Vosh. I know he's watching.
I forgive you, my father says.
I can't catch my breath. There's a sharp pain in my chest like a knife driving home. Please, I beg Vosh, please don't do this.
You had to leave, my father says. You didn't have a choice, and anyway, what happened is my own damn fault. You didn't make me a drunk.
Instinctively, I press my hands against my ears, but his voice isn't in the room, it's in me.
I didn't last long after you left,
my father tries to reassure me. Only a couple hours. We made it as far as Cincinnati, a little over 100 miles. Then his stash ran out. He begged me not to leave him, but I knew if I didn't find some alcohol fast, he'd die. I found some. A bottle of vodka tucked underneath a mattress, after breaking into 16 houses, if you can call it breaking in, since every house was abandoned and all I had to do was step through a broken window. I was so happy to find that bottle, I actually kissed it. But I was too late. He was dead by the time I made it back to our camp.
I know you beat yourself up over that, but I would have died either way, Marika. Either way. You did what you thought you had to do.
There's no hiding from his voice. No running from it either. I open my eyes and look straight into his. I know this is a lie. You aren't real. He smiles. The same smile as when I made a particularly good move in a match. The delighted teacher.
That's what I've come to tell you.
He rubs his long fingers against his thighs and I can see the dirt encrusted beneath the nails.
That's the lesson, Marika. That's what they want you to understand.
Warm hand against cool skin. He's touching my arm. The last time I felt his hand was against my cheek, in hard, stinging slaps while the other hand held me still.
Bitch, don't leave me. Don't you ever leave me, bitch.
Each bitch punctuated by a slap. His mind was gone. Seeing things that weren't there in the profound darkness that slammed down every night. Hearing things in the awful silence that threatened to crush you every day. On the night he died, he woke up screaming, clawing at his eyes. He could feel bugs inside them crawling. Those same swollen eyes staring at me now, and the claw marks beneath them still fresh. Another circle. Another silver cord. Now I am the one seeing things, hearing things, feeling things that aren't there in awful silence.
First they taught us not to trust them, he whispers. Then they taught us not to trust each other. Now they're teaching us we can't even trust ourselves.
And I whisper back, I don't understand. He's fading away. As I drop deeper into lightless depths, my father fades into depthless light. He kisses me on the forehead. A benediction.
A curse. You belong to them now.
Chapter 55. The chair is empty again. I'm alone. Then I remind myself I was alone when the chair wasn't empty. I wait for the pounding of my heart to subside. I will myself to stay calm, to control my breathing. The drug will work its way through my system and I'll be fine. You're safe, I tell myself, perfectly safe. The blonde recruit I punched in the throat comes in. He's carrying a tray of food, a slab of gray mystery meat, potatoes, a mushy pile of beans, and a tall glass of orange juice. He sets the tray by the bed, pushes the button to raise me to a sitting position, rotates the tray in front of me, then stands there, arms crossed, as if he's waiting for something.
"Let me know how it tastes," he whispers hoarsely. "I can't eat solid food for 3 more weeks.
His skin is fair, which makes his brown, deep-set eyes seem even darker. He isn't big, not buff like Zombie or blocky like Poundcake. He's tall and lean, a swimmer's body. There's a quiet intensity about him, in the way he carries himself, but especially in the eyes, a carefully contained force coiled just beneath the surface. I'm not sure what he expects me to say. Sorry.
Sucker punch.
Drumming his fingers on his forearm.
You're not going to eat?
I shake my head. Not hungry. Is the food real? Is the kid who brings the food real? The uncertainty of my own experience is crushing. I am drowning in an infinite sea. Sinking slowly, the weight of the lightless depths forcing me down, forcing the air from my lungs, squeezing the blood from my heart.
Drink the juice, he scolds. They said you should at least drink the juice.
Why? I manage to choke out. What's in the juice?
A little paranoid.
A little?
They just drained about a pint of blood from you. So they said make sure you drink the juice.
I have no memory of their taking my blood. Did that happen while I was talking to my father? Why are they draining my blood? Dead-eyed stare.
Let's see if I can remember. They tell me everything.
What did they tell you? Why am I here?
I'm not supposed to talk to you,
he says. Then,
they told us you're a VIP. Very important prisoner.
Shaking his head.
I don't get it. In the good old days, Dorothy's just disappeared.
I'm not a Dorothy. He shrugs.
I don't ask questions.
But I need him to answer some. Do you know what happened to Teacup?
Ran away with the spoon, what I heard.
That was the dish.
I was making a joke.
I don't get it.
Well, fuck you.
The little girl who choppered in with me, badly wounded. I need to know if she's alive. Nodding seriously.
I'll get right on that.
I'm going about this wrong. I was never good with people. My nickname in middle school was Her Majesty Marika and a dozen variations of the same. Maybe I should establish a rapport beyond F.U. My name's Ringer.
That's wonderful. You must be very satisfied with that.
You look familiar. Were you at Camp Haven? He starts to say something, stops himself.
I have orders not to talk to you.
I almost say, then why are you? But I catch myself. It's probably a good idea. They don't want you to know what I know.
Oh, I know what you know. It's all a lie. We've been tricked by the enemy. They're using us to wipe out survivors, blah, blah, blah. Typical Dorothy crap.
I used to think all that, I admit. Now I'm not so sure.
You'll figure it out.
I will. Rocks and rats and life forms evolved beyond the need for physical bodies. I'll figure it out, but probably too late, though it's probably already too late. Why did they take my blood? Why is Vosh keeping me alive? What could I have that he could possibly need? Why do they need me, this blonde kid or any human? If they could genetically engineer a virus that kills 9 out of 10 people, why not 10 out of 10? Or, as Vosh said, why bother with any of it when all you need is a very big rock? My head hurts. I'm dizzy. Nauseated. I miss being able to think clearly. It used to be my number one favorite thing.
Drink your damn juice so I can go, he says.
Tell me your name and I'll drink it.
He hesitates, then, Razor. I drink the juice. He picks up the tray and leaves. I got his name, at least. A minor victory.
Chapter 56. The woman in the white lab coat shows up. She says her name is Dr. Claire. Dark, wavy hair pulled back from her face, eyes the color of an autumn sky. She smells like bitter almonds, which is also the odor of cyanide.
Why did you take my blood?
She smiles.
Because Ringer is so sweet, we decided to clone 100 of her.
There is not a hint of sarcasm in her voice. She disconnects the IV and steps back quickly as if she's afraid I'll leap from the bed and strangle her. Strangling her did occur to me, briefly, but I'd rather stab her to death with a pocket knife. I don't know how many stabs that would take. A lot, probably. That's another thing that doesn't make sense, I tell her. Why download your consciousness into a human body when you can clone as many as you like in your mothership? Zero risk. Especially since one of your downloads can go all Evan Walker on you and fall in love with a human girl.
That's a good point.
Nodding seriously.
I'll bring that up at the next planning meeting. Maybe we need to rethink this whole hostile takeover thingy.
She motions toward the door.
March. Where?
You'll find out, don't worry.
Claire adds, you're going to enjoy it.
We don't go far. Two doors down.
The room is spare. A sink and a cabinet, a toilet and a shower stall.
How long has it been since you've had a decent shower?
She asks.
Camp Haven? The night before I shot my drill sergeant in the heart.
Did you?
She asks casually, as if I'd told her I used to live in San Francisco.
Towel right there. Toothbrush, comb, deodorant in the cabinet. I'll be right on the other side of the door. Knock if you need anything.
Alone, I open the cabinet. Roll-on antiperspirant, a comb, a travel-sized tube of toothpaste, a toothbrush and a plastic wrapper. No floss. I'd hoped there'd be floss. I waste a couple of minutes wondering how long it would take to sharpen the end of the toothbrush into a proper cutting instrument. Then I slip out of the jumpsuit and step into the shower, and I think of Zombie. Not because I'm naked in a shower, but remembering him talking about Facebook and drive-thrus and tardy bells, and the endless list of all things lost, like greasy fries and musty bookstores and hot showers. I turn the temperature as high as I can stand it and let the water rain over me until my fingertips pucker. Lavender soap. Fruity shampoo. The hard lump of the tiny transmitter rolls beneath my fingers. You belong to them now. I hurl the shampoo bottle against the shower wall. Slam my fist into the tile again and again until the skin on my knuckles splits open. My anger is greater than the sum of all lost things. Vosh is waiting for me back in the room two doors down. He says nothing as Claire bandages my hand, silent until we're alone.
What did you accomplish?
He asks.
I needed to prove something to myself. Pain being the only true proof of life?
I shake my head. I know I'm alive. He nods, thoughtfully.
Would you like to see her?
Teacup is dead.
Why do you think that?
There's no reason to let her live.
That's correct, if we proceed from the assumption that the only reason to keep her alive is to manipulate you.
Really, the narcissism of today's youth. He presses a button on the wall. A screen lowers from the ceiling. You can't force me to help you. Fighting down a rising sense of panic, of losing control of something I never had control over. Vosh holds out his hand. In his palm is a shiny green object the size and shape of a large gel capsule. A hair-thin wire protrudes from one end. This is the message. The lights dim. The screen flickers to life. The camera soars over a winter-killed field of wheat. In the distance, a farmhouse and a couple of outbuildings, a rusty silo. A tiny figure stumbles from a stand of trees bordering the field and lurches through the dry and broken stalks toward the cluster of buildings. That is the messenger. From this height,
I can't tell if it's a boy or a girl, only that it's a small child.
Nugget's age? Younger?
Central Kansas, Vosh goes on. Yesterday at approximately 1300 hours.
Another figure comes into view on the porch steps. After a minute, someone else comes out. The child begins to run toward them.
That isn't Teacup, I whisper.
No.
Crashing through the brittle chaff toward the adults who watch motionlessly, and one of them holds a gun, and there is no sound, which somehow makes it more terrible.
It's the ancient instinct. In times of great danger, be wary of strangers. Trust no one outside your circle.
My body tenses. I know how this ends. I lived it. The man with the gun?
Me.
The child crashing toward him. Teacup.
The child falls, gets up, runs, falls again.
But there's another instinct, far older. As old as life itself. Nearly impossible for the human mind to override. Protect the young at all costs. Preserve the future.
The child breaks through the weed into the yard and falls for the last time. The one with the gun doesn't lower it, but his companion races to the fallen child and scoops it off the frozen ground. The gunman blocks their way back into the house. The tableau holds for several seconds.
It's all about risk, Bosch observes.
You realized that long ago. So, of course, you know who will win the argument. After all, how much risk does a little child pose? Protect the young. Preserve the future.
The person carrying the child sidesteps the one with the gun and rushes up the steps into the house. The gunman drops his head as if in prayer, then lifts his head as if in supplication. Then he turns and goes inside. The minutes spin out.
Beside me, Vosh murmurs, "The world is a clock." The farmhouse, the outbuildings, the silo, the brown fields, and the blur of numbers as the time display at the bottom of the screen ticks off the seconds by the hundreds. I know what's coming, but still I flinch when the silent flash whites out the screen. Then roiling dust and debris and billowing smoke. The wheat is burning, consumed in a matter of seconds, tender fodder for the fire. And where the buildings used to be, a crater, a black hole bored into the earth. The feed goes black. The screen retracts. The lights stay dim.
I want you to understand, Vosh says gently.
You've wondered why we kept the little ones, the ones too young to fight.
I don't understand. Tiny figure in acres of brown, dressed in denim overalls, barefoot, running through the wheat. He misreads my confusion.
The device inside the child's body is calibrated to detect minute fluctuations in carbon dioxide, the chief component of human breath. When the CO2 reaches a certain threshold, indicating the presence of multiple targets, the device detonates.
No, I whisper. They brought him inside, wrapped him in a warm blanket, brought him water, washed his face. The group gathered around him, bathing him in their breath.
They'd be just as dead if you dropped a bomb. It isn't about the dead, he snaps impatiently. It never was.
The lights come up, the door comes open, and Claire comes in wheeling a metal cart, followed by her white-coated buddy and Razor, who looks at me and then looks away. That got to me more than the cart with its array of syringes. He couldn't bring himself to look at me.
It doesn't change anything, my voice rising. I don't care what you do. I don't even care about Teacup anymore. I'll kill myself before I help you.
He shakes his head. You're not helping me.
Chapter 57. Claire ties a rubber strap around my arm and taps the inside of my elbow to bring up a vein. Razor stands on the other side of the bed. The man in the white coat, I never got his name, is by the monitor holding a stopwatch. Vosh leans against the sink, watching me with bright, flinty eyes glittering like the crows in the woods on the day I shot Teacup, curious but curiously indifferent. And then I understand that Vosh is right.
The answer to their arrival is not rage. The answer is rage's opposite. The only possible answer is the opposite of all things, like the pit where the farmhouse once stood. Simply nothing. Not hate, not anger, not fear, not anything at all. Empty space. The soulless indifference of the shark's eye.
"Too high," murmured Mr. Whitecoat, looking at the monitor.
"First, something to relax you."
Claire slides the needle into my arm. I look at Razor. He looks away.
"Better,"
Whitecoat says.
"I don't care what you do to me," I tell Vosh. My tongue feels bloated, clumsy.
"It doesn't matter." He nods at Claire, who picks up the second syringe.
"Inserting the hub on my mark," she says.
"The hub?"
"Uh-oh," Whitecoat says. "Careful."
Eyeing the monitor as my heart rate kicks up a notch.
"Don't be afraid," Vosh says. "It won't harm you."
Claire gives him a startled look. He shrugs.
"Well, we ran tests."
He flicks his finger at her. "Get on with it." I weigh 10 million tons. My bones are iron, the rest is stone. I don't feel the needle slide into my arm. Claire says, "Mark," and Whitecoat clicks the stopwatch. The world is a clock.
"The dead have their reward," Vosh says. "It is the living, you and I, who still have work to do. Call it what you like, fate, luck, providence. You have been delivered into my hands to be my instrument."
"Appending to the cerebral cortex," from Claire.
Her voice sounds muffled, as if my ears had been stuffed with cotton. I roll my head toward her. 1,000 years go by.
"You've seen one before," Vosh says, 1,000 miles away. "In the testing room, on the day you arrived at Camp Haven, we told you it was an infestation of an alien life form attached to the human brain. That was a lie."
I can hear Razor breathing, loud, like a diver's breath through a regulator.
"It is actually a microscopic command hub affixed to the prefrontal lobe of your brain," Vosh says. "A CPU, if you will."
"Booting up," Claire says. "Looking good."
"Not to control you," Vosh says.
"Introducing first array."
Needle glinting in fluorescent light. Black specks suspended in amber fluid. I feel nothing as she injects it into my vein.
"But to coordinate the 40,000 or so mechanized guests to which you will play host." "Temp 99.6.
Whitecoat says. Razor beside me breathing.
"It took the prehistoric rats millions of years and 1,000 generations to reach the current stage in human evolution," Vosh says. "It will take you days to achieve the next."
"Link with the first array complete," Claire says, bending over me again.
Bitter almond breath.
"Introducing second array."
The room is furnace hot. I'm drenched in sweat. Whitecoat announces that my temperature is 102.
"It's a messy business, evolution," Vosh says. "Many false starts and blind alleys. Some candidates aren't suitable hosts. Their immune systems crash or they suffer from permanent cognitive dissonance. In layman's terms, they go mad."
I'm burning. My veins are filled with fire. Water flows from my eyes, trickles down my temples, pools in my ears. I see Vosh's face leaning over the surface of the undulating sea of my tears.
"But I have faith in you, Marika. You did not come through fire and blood only to fall now. You will be the bridge that connects what was to what will be."
"We're losing her," Whitecoat calls out, tremble-voiced.
"No," Vosh murmurs, cool hand on my wet cheek. "We have saved her." Chapter 58. There is no day or night anymore. Only the sterile glow of the fluorescent lights, and those lights never go out. I measure the hours by Razor's visits, 3 times a day to deliver meals I can't keep down. I can't control my fever. Can't stabilize my blood pressure.
Can't subdue my nausea. My body is rejecting the 11 arrays designed to augment each of my biological systems, each array consisting of 4,000 units, which makes a total of 44,000 microscopic robotic invaders coursing through my bloodstream. I feel like shit. After every breakfast, Claire comes in to examine me, tinker with my meds, and make cryptic remarks like, "You better start feeling better. The window of opportunity is closing." Or snide ones like, "I'm starting to think the whole very big rock idea was the right way to go." She seemed to resent that I reacted badly to her pumping me full of 44,000 alien mechanisms. "It's not like there's anything you can do about it," she told me once. "The procedure is irreversible."
"There is one thing."
"What? Oh, sure. Ringer the irreplaceable." She pulled the kill switch device from her lab coat pocket and held it up. "Got you keyed in. I'll push the button. Go ahead, tell me to push the button."
Smirking.
"Push the button." She laughed softly. "It's amazing. Whenever I start wondering what he sees in you, you say something like that."
"Who, Vosh?"
Her smile faded. Her eyes went shark-eyed blank. "We will terminate the upgrade if you can't adjust."
Terminate the upgrade.
She peeled the bandages away from my knuckles. No scabs, no bruises, no scars, as if it hadn't happened. As if I'd never pounded my fist into the wall until the skin split down to the bone. I thought of Vosh appearing in my room completely healed, days after I smashed his nose and gave him two black eyes. And Sullivan, who told the story of Evan Walker torn apart by shrapnel and yet somehow, hours later, able to infiltrate and take out an entire military installation by himself. First they took Marika and made her Ringer. Now they've taken Ringer and upgraded her into someone completely different. Someone like them. Or something. There is no day or night anymore. Only a constant, sterile glow. Chapter 59. "What have they done to me?" I ask Razor one day when he carts in another inedible meal. I don't expect an answer, but he's expecting me to ask the question. It must strike him as weird that I haven't. He shrugs, avoiding my gaze. "Let's see what's on the menu today. Ooh, meatloaf, lucky duck." I'm going to vomit. His eyes widen. "Really?" He looks around for the plastic upchuck container, desperate. "Please take the tray away, I can't." He frowns. "They'll pull the plug on you if you don't get your shit together." "They could have done this to anyone," I say. "Why do they do it to me?"
"Maybe you're special."
I shake my head and answer as if he was serious. "No, I think it's because someone else is." "Do you play chess?"
Startled. "Play what?"
"Maybe we could play when I'm feeling better."
"I'm more of a baseball guy."
"Really? I would have guessed swimming or tennis." He cocks his head, his eyebrows come together.
"You must be feeling bad, making conversation like you're halfway human."
"I am halfway human, literally. The other half..." I shrug. It coaxes out a grin.
"Oh, the 12th system is definitely theirs," he says.
"The 12th system? What did that mean exactly?" "I'm not sure, but I suspect it's in reference to the 11 normal systems of the human body. We found a way to yank them out of Ted's bodies and..." Razor trails off, giving the camera an abashed look.
"Anyway, you have to eat. I overheard them talking about a feeding tube."
"So that's the official story? Like Wonderland, we're using their technology against them. And you believe that?" He leans against the wall, crosses his arms over his chest, and hums, "Follow the yellow brick road." I shake my head. "Amazing. It isn't that the lies are too beautiful to resist. It's that the truth is too hideous to face."
"Commander Vosh is implanting bombs inside children. He's turning kids into IEDs, I tell him.
He hums louder.
"Little kids. Toddlers. They're separated when they come in, aren't they? They were at Camp Haven.
Anyone younger than 5 is carted off and you never see them again. Have you seen any? Where are the children, Razor? Where are they?
He stops humming long enough to say,
Shut up, Dorothy.
And does that make sense, loading up a Dorothy with superior alien technology? If Command decided to enhance people for the war, do you really think it would pick the crazy ones?
I don't know, they picked you, didn't they?
He grabs the tray of untouched food and heads for the door.
Don't go!
He turns, surprised. My face is hot. The fever must be spiking. That has to be it.
Why?
He asks. You're the only honest person I have left to talk to. He laughs. It's a good laugh, authentic, unforced. I like it, but I am feverish.
Who says I'm honest?
He asks. We're all enemies in disguise, right? My father used to tell the story about 6 blind men and an elephant. One man felt the elephant's leg and said an elephant must look like a pillar. Another felt the trunk and said an elephant must look like a tree branch. Blind guy number 3 felt the tail and said an elephant is like a rope. 4th guy feels the belly. The elephant is like a wall. 5th guy, ear. The elephant is shaped like a fan. 6th guy, a tusk, so an elephant must be like a pipe. Razor stares at me stone-faced for a long moment, then smiles. It's a good smile. I like it, too.
That's a beautiful story. You should tell it at parties.
The point is, I tell him, from the moment their ship appeared, we've all been blind men patting an elephant. Chapter 60. In the constant, sterile glow, I measure the days by the uneaten meals he brings. 3 meals, 1 day. 6, 2 days. On the 10th day, after he sets the tray in front of me, I ask him,
Why do you bother?
My voice like his now, a throaty croak. I'm soaked in sweat, fever spiking, head pounding, heart racing. He doesn't answer. Razor hasn't spoken to me in 17 meals. He seems jittery, distracted, even angry. Claire's gone silent, too. She comes twice a day to change my IV bag, look into my eyes with an otoscope, test my reflexes, change out the catheter bag, and empty the bedpan. Every 6th meal, I get a sponge bath. One day, she brings a tape measure and wraps it around my biceps, I guess to see how much muscle I've lost. I don't see anyone else. No Mr. Whitecoat. No Vosh or dead fathers pumped into my head by Vosh. I'm not so out of it that I don't know what they're doing. Holding vigil. Waiting to see if the enhancement kills me. She's rinsing out the bedpan one morning when Razor comes in with my breakfast. And he waits silently until she's finished, and then I hear him whisper, Is she dying? Claire shakes her head. Ambivalent. Could be no. Could be, Your guess is as good as mine. I wait till she's gone to say, You're wasting your time. He glances at the camera mounted in the ceiling. I just do what they tell me. I pick up the tray and hurl it onto the floor. His lips tighten, but he doesn't say anything. Silently, he cleans up the mess while I lie panting, exhausted from the effort, sweat pouring off me. Yeah, pick that up, make yourself useful. When my fever shoots up, something in my mind loosens. And I imagine I can feel the 44,000 microbots swarming in my bloodstream, and the hub with its delicate lace of tendrils burrowed into every lobe. And I understand what my father felt in his dying hours as he clawed at himself to subdue the imaginary insects crawling beneath his skin.
Bitch, I gasp.
From the floor, Razor looks up at me, startled.
Leave me, bitch.
No problem, he mutters. On his hands and knees, using a wet rag to mop up the mess and the tart smell of disinfectant.
Fast as I can.
He stands up. His ivory cheeks are flushed. Deliriously, I think the color brings out the auburn highlights in his blonde hair.
It won't work, he tells me. Starving yourself? So you better think of something else.
I've tried. But there's no alternative. I can barely lift my head. You belong to them now. Vosh the sculptor, my body the clay. But not my spirit, never my soul. Unconquered, uncrushed, uncontained.
I am not bound. They are. Languish, die, or recover. The game's over. The Grandmaster Vosh mated. My father had a favorite saying, I tell Razor. We call chess the game of kings because, through chess, we learn how to rule kings. Again with the chess! He drops the dirty rag into the sink and slams out the door. When he returns with the next meal, there's a familiar wooden box beside the tray. Without a word, Razor picks up the food and dumps it into the trash, tosses the metal tray into the sink, where it lands with a loud clang. The bed hums, maneuvering my body into a sitting position, and he slides the box in front of me.
You said you didn't play, I whisper.
So teach me. I shake my head and say to the camera behind him, Nice try, but stuff it up your ass. Razor laughs. Not their idea. But speaking of asses, you can bet yours I got permission first. He opens the box, pulls out the board, fumbles with the pieces. You got your queens and kings and the prawns and these guard tower-looking things. How come every piece is like a person except those? Pawns, not prawns. A prawn is a big shrimp. He nods. That's the name of a guy in my unit. Shrimp? Prawn. Never knew what the hell it meant. You're setting it up wrong. That could be because I don't know how to freaking play. You do it. I don't want to do it. Then you're conceding defeat? Resigning. It's called resigning. That's good to know. I have a feeling that'll come in handy. Smiling. Not the zombie high voltage type. Smaller. Subtler. More ironic. He sits beside the bed and I catch a whiff of bubblegum. White or black? Razor, I'm too weak to even lift. Then you point where you want to go and I'll move you. He's not giving up. I didn't really expect him to. By this point, wafflers and wusses have been winnowed out. There are no pussies left. I tell him where to place the pieces and how each one moves, describe the basic rules. Lots of nodding and uh-huhs, but I get the feeling there's a lot of agreeing and not much grasping. Then we play, and I slaughter him in four moves. The next game, he falls into arguing and denying. You can't do that! Tell me that isn't the stupidest damn rule ever! Game three, and I'm sure he's regretting the whole idea. My spirits aren't being lifted, and his are being totally crushed. This is the dumbest-ass game ever invented, he pouts. Chess wasn't invented, it was discovered. Like America? Like mathematics. I knew girls just like you in school. He leaves the point there and starts to set up the board again. That's all right, Razor, I'm tired. Tomorrow I'm bringing some checkers. Spoken like a threat. He doesn't, though. Tray, box, board. This time he sets up the pieces in a strange configuration. The black king in the center facing him, the queen on the edge facing the king, three pawns behind the king at 10, 12, and 2 o'clock, one knight on the king's right, another on his left, a bishop directly behind him, and, next to the bishop, another pawn. Then Razor looks at me, wearing that seraphic grin. Okay. I'm nodding, not sure why. I've invented a game. Are you ready? It's called... He taps on the bed rail to produce a drum roll. Chase ball. Chase ball? Chess, baseball. Chase ball. Get it? He plops a coin beside the board. What's that? I ask. It's a quarter. I know it's a quarter. For the purposes of the game, it's the ball. Well, not really the ball, but it represents the ball, or what happens with the ball. If you'd be quiet a second, I could explain all the rules. I wasn't talking. Good, you give me a headache when you talk. Name-calling and Yoda quotes about chess and cryptic elephant stories, you want to play or not? He doesn't wait for an answer. He places a white pawn just in front of the black queen, saying that's him, the batter. You should lead off with your queen. She's the most powerful. That's why she bats cleanup. He shakes his head. My ignorance is astounding. Real simple. Defense, that's you, flips first. Heads, it's a strike. Tails, a ball. A coin won't work, I point out. There are three possibilities, strike, ball, or a hit. Actually, there are four counting fouls. You stick to chess, I'll handle baseball.
Chase ball, I correct him.
Anyway, if you flip a ball, that's a ball, and you flip again. Comes up heads, though, and then I get the coin. See, that gives me a chance to get a hit. Heads I connect, tails I miss. If I miss, strike one. And so on.
I get it, and if you flip heads, I get the coin back to see if I can field it.
Heads I throw you out. Wrong, so wrong, no. First I flip three times, four times if I get a TT.
TT?
Two tails, that's a triple.
With a TT you get one more flip.
Heads is a home run, tails just a triple.
Heads-heads is a single, heads-tails is a double.
Maybe we should just start playing and you can...
Then you get the coin back to see if you can field my potential single, double, triple, or homer.
Heads, I'm out. Tails, I'm on base.
He takes a deep breath.
Unless it's a home run, of course.
Of course.
Are you making fun of me? Because I don't know...
I'm just trying to absorb...
It kind of sounds like you are. You have no idea how long it took me to come up with this. It's pretty complicated. I mean, not like the game of kings, but you know what they call baseball, don't you?
The national pastime.
Baseball is called the national pastime because by playing it, we learn how to master time. Or the past. One of them.
Now you're the one making fun of me.
Actually, I'm the only one making fun of you right now.
He waits.
I know what he's waiting for.
You never smile.
Does it matter? Once when I was a kid, I laughed so hard, I peed my pants. We were at Six Flags, the Ferris wheel.
What made you laugh?
I can't remember now.
He slides his hand beneath my wrist and lifts my arm to press the quarter into my upturned palm.
Flip the damn coin so we can play.
I don't want to hurt his feelings, but the game isn't that complicated.
He gets very excited on his first hit, triumphantly fist-pumping, then proceeding to move the black pieces around the board while he calls the play in a hoarse, high-pitched imitation of an announcer's voice, like a kid playing with action figures.
It's a deep drive into center field!
The center field pawn slides towards second base, the bishop second baseman and the pawn shortstop drop back, and the left field pawn runs up, then cuts towards center. That's with one hand while the other manipulates the quarter, turning it in his fingers like a ball spinning in flight, lowering it as if in slow motion to land in center left field. It's so ridiculous and childish that I would have smiled if I still smiled.
He's safe,
Razor bellows. No, not childish. Childlike. Eyes fever bright, voice rising in excitement. He's 10 again. Not all things are lost. Not the important things. His next hit is a blooper that drops between first base and right field. He creates a dramatic collision between my fielder and baseman, first base sliding back, right field sliding up, then smack! Razor cackles at the impact.
Wouldn't that be an error? I ask. It's a catchable ball.
Catchable ball?
Ringer.
It's just a dorky game I made up in 5 minutes with a bunch of chess pieces and a quarter. Two more hits. He's 3 runs up at the top of the first. I've always sucked at games of chance. Always hated them for that reason. Razor must sense my enthusiasm waning. He amps up the commentary while sliding the pieces around, despite my pointing out they're my pieces, since I'm on defense. Another drive deep center left. Another floater behind first base. Another impact of first baseman and outfielder. I don't know if he's repeating himself because he thinks it's funny or because he has a serious deficit in imagination. There's a part of me that feels as if I should be deeply affronted on behalf of chess players everywhere. By the third inning, I'm exhausted.
Let's pick it up again tonight, I suggest.
Or tomorrow. Tomorrow would be better.
What? You don't like it?
No, it's fun. I'm just tired. Really tired. He shrugs like it doesn't matter, which it does, or he wouldn't shrug. He slips the quarter back into his pocket and packs up the box, muttering under his breath. I catch the word chess.
What did you say?
Nothing. Cutting his eyes away. Something about chess. Chess, 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 chess on the brain. Sorry, Chasefall has nothing on chess in the sheer thrill category. He shoves the box under his arm and stomps to the door. One last parting shot before he goes. I thought maybe I'd cheer you up a little, that's all. Thanks. We don't have to play anymore. Are you angry at me? I gave chess a chance, didn't I? You didn't see me bitching. I didn't. And you did, a lot. Just think about it. Think about what? He shouts across the room. Just think about it! He slams out of the room. I'm out of breath, shaky, and can't figure out why. Chapter 61. I'm ready with an apology when the door opens that night. The more I think about it with my feverish mind, the more I feel like the bully at the beach who kicks over some little kid's sandcastle. Hey, Razor, I'm... My mouth drops open. There's a stranger holding the tray. A kid around 12 or 13. Where's Razor? I ask. Well, more like demand. I don't know, the kid squeaks. They handed me the tray and said take it. Take it, I echo stupidly. Yeah, take it. Take the tray. They pulled Razor off ringer duty. Maybe chase balls against regs. Maybe Vosh got ticked. Two kids acting like kids for a couple of hours. Despair is addictive for the one watching it and the one experiencing it. Or maybe Razor's the ticked party here. Maybe he asked to be reassigned, took his chase ball and went home. I didn't sleep well that night, if you can call it night under the constant sterile glow. My fever shoots up to 103 as my immune system launches its final, desperate assault on the arrays. I can see the blurry green numbers on the monitor inching upward. I slip into a semi-delirious doze. Bitch! Leave me. You know why they call it baseball, don't you? It's a deep drive into center field. I'm done. Take care of yourself. The grungy silver turning in Razor's fingers. It's a deep drive. A deep drive. Lowering toward the board in slow motion where the fielders come up. Second base and shortstop go back. Left goes right. Blooper on the first base line. Fielder races up. Baseman back. Boom. Fielders up. Infield back. Cut to the right. First baseman back. Right fielder up. Boom. Up. Back. Cut. Back. Up. Boom. Over and over. Let's go to the instant replay. Up. Back. Cut. Back. Up. Boom. Now I'm wide awake, staring at the ceiling. No, can't see it as well. Better with my eyes closed. Center and left slash down. Left cuts across. H. Right steps up. First base runs back. I. Oh, come on. Ridiculous. You're delusional. When I got back to our camp that night with the vodka, I found my dead father curled into a fetal position. His face covered in blood where he had clawed at the bugs born inside his mind. Bitch, he called me before I left to find the poison that would save him. He called me another name, too. The name of the woman who left us when I was 3. He thought I was my mother, which was ironic. From the time I was 14, I was more like his mother, feeding him, washing his clothes, taking care of the house, making sure he didn't do something catastrophically stupid to himself. And every day I went to school in my perfectly pressed uniform and they called me Her Majesty Marika and said I thought I was better than everybody else because my father was a semi-famous artist, the reclusive genius type. When the truth was that most days my father didn't know what planet he was on. By the time I got home from school, he'd be full-on delusional. And I let people on the outside hold their delusions, too. I let them think I thought I was better, the way I let Sullivan think she was right about me. I didn't just foster the delusions. I lived them. Even after the world crashed around us, I clung to them. But after he died, I told myself no more. No more brave fronts or false hopes or pretending everything's okay when nothing is. I thought I was being tough by pretending, calling it being optimistic, brave, keeping my head up or whatever bullshit seemed to fit the moment. That's not tough.
That's the very definition of soft. I was ashamed of his disease and angry at him. But I was just as guilty. I played right into the lies right up to the end. When he called me my mother's name, I didn't correct him. Delusional. In the corner, the camera's blank, soulless eye staring. What did Razor say? Just think about it. That's not all you said, is it? I ask him, looking blankly back at the blank, black eye. That isn't everything. Chapter 62. I hold my breath when the door opens the next morning. All night I seesawed between belief and doubt. I wallowed in every aspect of the new reality. First option. Razor didn't invent chase ball any more than I invented chess. The game is Vosh's creation for reasons too murky to see clearly. Second option. Razor, for reasons only clear to Razor, has decided to seriously mess with my head. It wasn't just the hard-hearted and resilient who survived the winnowing of the human race. A lot of sadistic assholes persisted, too. That's the way of every human catastrophe. The douchebag is nearly indestructible. Third option. All of it is entirely in my head. Chase ball is a silly game made up by a kid to take my mind off the fact that I may be dying. There's no other point. No secret messages traced on a chessboard. My seeing letters where there are no letters is the human brain's tendency to find patterns, even where there are no patterns. And I hold my breath for another reason. What if it's the squeaky-voiced kid again? What if Razor doesn't come back, ever come back? There's a real possibility that Razor is dead. If he was trying to secretly communicate with me and Vosh figured it out, I'm sure Vosh's response would be one thing and only one thing. I let out my breath slow and steady when he steps into the room. The beeping of the monitor kicks up a notch.
What?
Razor asks, narrowing his eyes at me. He senses something's up right away. I say it.
Hi.
His eyes cut right, cut left.
Hi.
Drawing the tiny word out slowly, as if he's not sure if he's with a lunatic.
Hungry?
I shake my head. Not really.
You should try to eat this. You look like my cousin Stacy. She was a meth addict. I don't mean you literally look like a meth addict, just...
Face turning red.
You know, like something is eating you from the inside.
He pushes the button beside the bed. I rise. He says,
You know what I'm addicted to? Sour Patch Kids. Raspberry. Not so crazy about the lemon. I have a stash. I'll bring you some if you want.
He sets the tray in front of me. Cold scrambled eggs, fried potatoes, a blackened, crusty thing that may or may not be bacon. My stomach clenches. I look up at him.
Try the eggs, he suggests. They're fresh. Free-range, organic, chemical-free. We raise them right here in camp. The chickens, not the eggs.
Dark, soulful eyes and that small, mysterious, beatific smile. What did his reaction mean when I said hi? Was he startled I offered him a halfway human greeting, or was he startled because I had figured out the real point of chase ball? Or was he not startled at all and I'm picking up cues that aren't there?
I don't see the box.
What box?
Oh, it was kind of a stupid game.
He looks away and says softly to himself, I miss baseball. He's quiet for the next couple of minutes while I move the cold eggs around the plate. I miss baseball. A universe of loss in four syllables.
No, I liked it, I tell him. It was fun. Really?
A look.
Are you serious?
He doesn't know that I am 99.999999% of the time.
You didn't seem too down with it at the time.
I guess I'm just not feeling well lately. He laughs and then seems surprised at his own reaction.
Okay, well, I left it in my quarters. I'll bring it someday if nobody swipes it.
The conversation meanders off the game. I discover Razor was the youngest of five kids, grew up in Ann Arbor, where his dad worked as an electrician and his mom as a middle school librarian, played baseball and soccer, and loved Michigan football.
Until he was 12, his great ambition was to be the starting quarterback for the Wolverines. But he grew tall, not big, and baseball became his passion. Mom wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer, but the old man didn't think I was smart enough.
Wait, your dad didn't think you were smart?
Smart enough. There's a difference. Defending his father even in death. People die, love endures. He wanted me to be an electrician like him. Dad was a big union guy, president of his local, stuff like that. That was the real reason he didn't want me to be a lawyer. Suits, he called them.
He had a problem with authority. Razor shrugs.
Be your own man, he always said. Don't be the man's man.
He shuffles his feet, embarrassed, like he's talking too much.
What about your old man?
He was an artist.
That's cool.
He was also a drunk. Did more drinking than painting.
Though not always.
Yellowed photographs of showings hanging crooked in dusty frames, and the students buzzing in his studio nervously cleaning brushes, and the cathedral hush that fell when he walked into a crowded room.
What kind of shit did he paint?
Razor asks. Mostly that.
Shit?
Not always, though. Not when he was younger and I was small, and the hand that held mine was stained with rainbow colors. He laughs.
The way you joke. Like you don't even know it's a joke, and it's your own joke.
I shake my head. I wasn't joking.
He nods. Maybe that's why you don't know it.
Chapter 63. After the evening meal I don't eat, and the forced banter and the minuscule awkward silences that drop between our sentences, and after the board comes out of the wooden box and he's set up the pieces and we flip to see who's the home team and he wins, I tell him I think I can handle my own fielding, and he smirks.
Yeah, right, let's go, girl.
After he's sitting beside me on the edge of the bed, and after weeks of learning to let go of my rage and embrace the howling emptiness, and after years of erecting fortress walls around pain and loss, and the feeling that I will never feel again, after losing my father and losing Teacup and losing Zombie, and losing everything but the howling emptiness, and that is nothing, nothing at all, I silently say the word, hi. Razor nods.
Yeah.
He taps his finger on the blanket. I feel the tap against my thigh.
Yeah.
Tap.
Not bad, though it's cooler when you do it in slow-mo.
He demonstrates.
Get it now?
If you insist, I sigh. Yeah. I tap my finger on the bed rail. Well, to be honest, I don't really see the point.
No?
Tap tap on the blanket. No. Tap tap on the rail. The next word takes over 20 minutes to trace. HLP. Tap.
Did I ever tell you about my summer job before there were no more summer jobs? He asks. Dog grooming. Worst part of the job? Expressing the anal glands.
He's on a roll. 4 runs and not a single out. How? I won't get an answer for another 40 minutes. I'm a little tired and more than a little frustrated. This is like texting with someone 1,000 miles away using one-legged runners. Time slows down. Events speed up. PLN. I have no idea what that means. I look at him, but he's looking at the board, moving the pieces back into position, talking, filling in the tiny silences that drop, stuffing the empty space with chatter.
That's what they actually call it, expressing, he says, still on the dogs. Rinse, wash, rinse, express, repeat. So freaking boring.
And the black, soulless, unblinking eye of the camera staring down. I didn't understand that last play, I tell him.
Chaseball isn't some lame-ass game like chess, he says patiently.
There are intricacies. Intricacies. To win, you gotta have a plan. And that's you, I guess. The man with the plan.
Yes, that's me.
Tap. Chapter 64. I hadn't seen Vosh in days. That changes the next morning.
Let's hear it, he tells Claire, who's standing beside Mr. Whitecoat looking like a middle schooler dragged into the principal's office for bullying the scrawny kid.
She's lost 8 pounds and 20% of her muscle mass. She's on Diavan for the high blood pressure, Finergan for the nausea, amoxicillin and streptomycin to keep her lymphatic system tamped down. But we're still struggling with the fever, Claire reports.
Struggling with the fever?
Claire's eyes cut away.
On the upside, her liver and kidneys are still functioning normally. A bit of fluid in her lungs, but we're...
Fosh waves her off and steps up to my bedside, bright bird eyes glittering.
Do you want to live?
I answer without hesitating. Yes.
Why?
The question takes me off guard for some reason. I don't understand.
You cannot overcome us. No one can. Not if you numbered 7 times 7 billion when it began. The world is a clock, and the clock has wound to its final second. Why would you want to live?
I don't want to save the world, I tell him. I'm just hoping I might get the opportunity to kill you. His expression doesn't change, but his eyes glitter and dance.
I know you, his eyes say. I know you.
Hope, he whispers.
Yes.
Nodding. He's pleased with me. Hope, Marika.
Cling to your hope.
He turns to Claire and Mr. Whitecoat.
Pull her off the meds.
Mr. Whitecoat's face turns the color of his smock. Claire starts to say something, then looks away. Vosh turns back to me.
What is the answer?
He demands.
It isn't rage. What is it?
Indifference.
Try again.
Detachment. Again. Hope. Despair. Love. Hate. Anger. Sorrow. I'm shaking. My fever must be spiking. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know!
Better, he says.
Chapter 65. It gets so bad that night I can barely make it through 4 innings of chase ball.
Ex-meds.
Heard a rumor going around they took you off your meds, Razor says, shaking the quarter in his closed fist. True. The only thing left in my IV bag is saline to keep my kidneys from shutting down. He glances at my vitals on the monitor, frowning. When Razor frowns, he reminds me of a little boy who stubbed his toe and thinks he's too big to cry.
So you must be getting better.
Guess so. Tap tap on the bed rail.
Okay, he breathes.
My queen is up, look out. My back stiffens. My vision blurs. I lean to the side and empty my stomach, what little is inside my stomach, onto the white tile. Razor leaps up with a disgusted cry, toppling the board.
Hey!
He shouts. Not at me. At the black eye above us.
Hey, a little help here!
No help comes. He looks at the monitor, looks at me, and says,
I don't know what to do. I'm okay. Sure, you're fine, just fine.
He goes to the sink, wets a clean towel, and lays it across my forehead.
Find my ass! Why the hell did they take you off the meds?
Why not? I'm fighting the urge to hurl again.
Oh, I don't know, maybe because you'll die without them?
He glares at the camera. Maybe you should hand me that container over there. He dabs at the crud sticking on my chin, refolds the cloth, grabs the container, and places it on my lap.
Razor?
Yeah?
Please don't put that back on my face.
Huh?
Oh, shit, yeah, hang on.
He grabs a clean towel and runs it under the water. His hands are shaking.
You know what it is? I know what it is. Why didn't I think of it? Why didn't you think of it? The meds must be interfering with the system.
What system?
The 12th system. The one they injected into you, Sherlock. The hub and his 44,000 little friends to supercharge the other 11.
He puts the cool towel on my forehead.
You're cold. You want me to find another blanket?
No, I'm burning up.
It's a war, he says. He taps his chest. In here. You gotta declare a truce, Ringer.
I shake my head. No peace. He nods, squeezing my wrist beneath the thin blanket. Squats on the floor to gather the fallen chess pieces. Curses when he can't find the quarter. Decides he can't leave the vomit just lying there. Grabs the dirty towel he used to wipe my chin and swabs the deck on his hands and knees. He's still cursing when the door opens and Claire comes into the room.
Good timing! Razor barks at her. Hey, can't you at least give her the anti-puke serum?
Claire jerks her head toward the door.
Get out!
She points at the box.
And take that with you!
Razor glowers at her, but he does it. I see again the tightly contained force behind his angelic features. Careful, Razor. That's not the answer. Then we're alone, and Claire studies the monitor for a long, silent moment.
Were you telling the truth earlier? She asks. You want to live so you can kill Commander Vosh? You're smarter than that.
In the tone of a mother scolding a very young child.
You're right, I answer. I'll never get the chance.
But I'm going to have the opportunity to kill you. She looks startled.
Kill me? Why would you want to kill me?
When I don't answer, she says, I don't think you're going to live through the night. I nod. And you're not going to live out the month. She laughs. The sound of her laughter causes bile to rise into my throat. Burning. Burning.
What are you going to do?
She says softly. She yanks the towel from my forehead.
Smother me with this?
No. I'm going to overcome the guard by smashing his head in with a heavy object, and then I'm going to take his gun and shoot you in the face. She laughs through the whole thing.
Well, good luck with that.
It won't be luck. Chapter 66. Claire turns out to be wrong about me being dead by morning. Nearly a month later, by my reckoning of 3 meals per day, and I'm still here. I don't remember much. At some point, they disconnected me from the IV and the monitor, and the silence that slammed down after the constant beeping was loud enough to crack mountains. The only person I saw during that time was Razor. He's my full-time caretaker now. Feeds me, empties my bedpan, washes my face and hands, turns me so I don't develop bed sores, plays chase ball in the hours when I'm not delirious, and talks non-stop. He talks about everything, which is another way of saying he talks about nothing. His dead family, his dead friends, his squad mates, the drudgery of winter camp, the fights born of boredom and fatigue and fear, but mostly fear, the rumors that when spring comes the Teds are launching a major offensive, a last-ditch effort to purge the world of the human noise, of which Razor is very much an active part. He talks, and talks, and talks. He had a girlfriend, her name was Olivia, and her skin was dark like a muddy river, and she played clarinet in the school band and was going to be a doctor, and hated Razor's dad because he didn't think Razor could be a doctor. He lets it slip that his given name is Alex, like A-Rod, and his drill sergeant named him Razor not because he was slender, but because he cut himself shaving one morning. I have very sensitive skin. His sentences are without periods, without commas, without paragraphs, or, to be accurate, it's all one long paragraph with no margins. He shuts up just one time after nearly a month of the verbal diarrhea. He's going on about how he won first place in the 5th grade science fair with his project about how to turn a potato into a battery when he stops in mid-sentence. His silence is jarring, like the stillness after a building implodes.
What is that?
He asks, staring intently into my face. And nobody stares more intently than Razor, not even Vosh.
Nothing.
I turn my head away from him.
Are you crying, Ringer?
My eyes are watering.
No.
Don't tell me no, Razor. I don't cry.
Bullshit.
A tap on the blanket. Tap, tap on the railing. Did it work? I ask, turning back to him. What does it matter if he sees me cry? The potato battery.
Sure it worked. It's science. Never a doubt about it working. You plan it all out, follow the steps, and it can't go wrong.
Squeezing my hand through the blanket. Don't be scared. Everything's set. I won't let you down. It's too late to go back now anyway.
His eyes wandered to the food tray beside the bed.
You ate all the pudding tonight. You know how they make chocolate pudding without chocolate? You don't want to know.
Let me guess. Ex-lax.
What's ex-lax?
Seriously, you don't know?
Oh, so sorry, I don't know what ex-lax who gives a shit is.
It's a chocolate-flavored laxative. He makes a face.
That's sick.
That's the point. He grins.
The point? Oh, God, did you just make a joke?
How would I know? Just promise me nobody slipped ex-lax into my pudding.
Promise.
Tap. I last for a few hours after he leaves, long after lights out in every other part of the camp, deep into the belly of the winter night, before the pressure becomes unbearable, and then, when I can't take it anymore, I start shouting for help, waving at the camera, and then rolling over to press my chest against the cold metal railings, pounding my fist into the pillow in frustration and fury, until the door bursts open and Claire charges in, followed closely by a big bear of a recruit, whose hand immediately flies to cover his nose.
What happened? Claire says, though the smell should tell her all she needs to know.
Oh, crap, the recruit burbles behind his hand.
Exactly, I gasp. Great, just great, Claire says, throwing the blanket and sheet onto the floor and motioning for the recruit to help her. Fine job, Missy. I hope you're proud of yourself.
Not yet, I whimper.
What are you doing?
Claire shouts at the recruit. Gone is the soft voice. Vanished are the kind eyes.
Help me with this!
Help you with what, ma'am?
He has a flattened nose and very small eyes and a forehead that bulges in the middle. His belly hangs over his belt and his pants are an inch too short. He's huge. He's got about 100 pounds or more on me. It won't matter.
Get up! Claire snaps at me. Come on, get your legs under you!
She takes one arm and Jumbo Recruit takes the other and together they haul me out of the bed. Big Recruit's smushed in face is twisted with revulsion.
Oh, God, it's everywhere,
he softly wails.
I don't think I can walk,
I tell Claire.
Then I'll make you crawl, she snarls. I should just leave you like this. It's so perfectly metaphorical.
They haul me 2 doors down and into the shower room. Big Recruit is coughing and gagging, and Claire is bitching, and I am apologizing while she strips off the jumpsuit and throws it at Jumbo Recruit, telling him to wait outside.
Don't lean on me, lean on the wall,
she orders harshly. My knees are buckling. I hang onto the shower curtain to keep upright. I haven't used my legs in a month. With one hand locked around my left arm, Claire pushes me under the water, bending at the waist to stay dry. The spray is icy. She didn't bother to adjust the temperature. The slap of cold water against my body is like an alarm going off, snapping me from a long winter's hibernation. And I reach up and grab the showerhead pipe coming from the wall and tell Claire I think I've got it. I think I can stand. She can let go.
Are you sure?
She asks, holding on.
Pretty sure.
I wrench the pipe downward with all the force I have. The pipe breaks off at the joint with a metallic squeal, and the cold water gushes out in a ropey snarl. Left arm up, slipping through Claire's fingers, then I've got her by the wrist, and I swing my body toward her, rotating my hips to maximize the blow, and slam the jagged edge of the broken pipe into her neck. I wasn't sure I could break a steel pipe with my bare hands, but I was pretty sure. I have been enhanced. Chapter 67. Claire staggers away, blood pouring from the 2-inch puncture wound in her neck. The fact that I didn't drop her doesn't surprise me. I'd assumed she would be enhanced, too, but I'd hoped to get lucky and sever her carotid artery. She fumbles in the pocket of her lab coat for the kill switch. I anticipated that. I toss the broken pipe away, grab the bolted-in shower rod, break it from its brackets, and smash one end into the side of her head. The impact barely rocks her. In a millisecond, faster than my eyes can follow the motion, she has the end of the rod in her grip. I let go in half a millisecond, so when she yanks, there's nothing holding the other end, and she stumbles back into the wall, hitting with enough force to crack the tiles. I barrel toward her. She swings the rod toward my head, but I anticipated that, too. Counted on it when I rehearsed this in the 1,000 silent hours beneath the constant glow.
I grab the other end of the rod as it arcs toward me, first with my right hand, then with the left, hands shoulder-width apart, and power the rod into her neck, spreading my legs for the balance and leverage necessary to crush her windpipe. Our faces are inches apart. I'm close enough to smell the cyanide breath trickling out of her parted lips. Her hands are on either side of mine, pushing back while I push forward. The floor is slick. I'm barefoot. She isn't. I'm going to lose the advantage before she blacks out. I have to drop her, fast. I slide my foot to the inside of her ankle and kick out. Perfect. She falls to the floor and I follow her down. She lands on her back. I land on her stomach. I clamp my knees tightly against her sides and shove the rod down hard into her neck. Then the door behind us flies open and Jumbo Recruit lumbers in, gun drawn, shouting incoherently. 3 minutes in and the light in Claire's eyes is fading, but it's not all the way out, and I know I have to take a risk. I don't like risk, never did. I just learned to accept it. Some things you can choose and some you can't, like Sullivan's crucifix soldier, like teacup, like going back for zombie and nugget because not going back meant there's no value to anything anymore, not life, not time, not promises. And I have a promise to keep. Jumbo's gun. The 12th system locks in on it, and thousands of microscopic droids go to work augmenting the muscles, tendons, and nerves in my hands, eyes, and brain to neutralize the threat. In a microsecond, objective identified, information processed, method determined. Jumbo doesn't have a prayer. The attack happens faster than his unenhanced brain can process it. I doubt he even sees the curtain rod whizzing toward his hand. The gun flies across the room. He goes one way, for the gun, while I go the other, for the toilet. The tank lid is solid ceramic, and heavy. I could kill him. I don't. But I smack him hard enough in the back of the head to put him out for a long time. Jumbo falls down. Claire rises up. I sling the lid toward her head. Her arm rises to block the projectile. My enriched hearing picks up the sound of a bone snapping from the collision. The silver device in her hand clatters to the floor. She dives for it as I step forward. I slam one foot on her outstretched hand and with the other kick the device to the other side of the room. Done. And she knows it. She looks past the barrel of the gun leveled at her face. Beyond the tiny hole filled with immense nothingness. Into my eyes. And hers are kind again, and her voice is soft again, the bitch. Marika. No. Marika was slow, weak, sentimental, dim-witted. Marika was a little girl clinging to rainbow fingers, helplessly watching the time wind down, teetering on the razor's edge of the bottomless abyss, exposed behind her fortress walls by promises she could never keep. But I will keep her final promise to Claire, the beast who stripped her naked and baptized her in the cold water that still roars in the broken shower. I will keep Marika's promise. Marika is dead, and I will keep her promise. My name is Ringer. I pull the trigger. Chapter 68. Jumbo should have a knife on him. Standard issue for all recruits. I kneel beside his unconscious body, slip the knife from its sheath, and carefully cut out the pellet embedded near the spinal cord at the base of his skull. I slip it between my cheek and gums. Now mine. No pain when I cut it out, and only a small amount of blood trickles from the incision. Bots to deaden sensation. Bots to repair damage. That's why Claire didn't die when I rammed a broken pipe into her neck and why, after the initial gush, the bleeding quickly stopped. Also why, after 6 weeks flat on my back with very little food and a burst of intense physical activity, I'm not even out of breath. I insert the tiny pellet from my neck into Jumbo's. Track me now, Commander Asshole. Fresh jumpsuit from the stack under the sink. Shoes. Claire's feet are too small. Jumbo's much too large. I'll work on the shoes later. The big kid's leather jacket might come in handy, though. The jacket hangs on me like a blanket, but I like the extra room in the sleeves. There's something I'm forgetting. I glance around the small room. The kill switch, that's it. The screen got cracked in the melee, but the device still works. A number glows above the flashing green button, my number. I swipe my thumb over the display and the screen fills with numbers, hundreds of sequences representing every recruit on the base. I swipe again to return to my number, tap on it, and a map pops up showing my implant's precise location. I zoom out and the screen fills with tiny glowing green dots, the location of every implanted soldier in the entire base. Jackpot. And checkmate. With a swipe of my thumb and a tap of my finger, I can highlight all the numbers. The button on the bottom of the device will light up. A final tap, and every recruit neutralized. Gone. I can practically stroll out. I can, if I'm willing to step over several hundred corpses of innocent human beings, kids who are no less victims than I am, whose sole crime is the sin of hope. If the wage of sin is death, then virtue is a vice now. A defenseless, starving child lost in a wheat field is given shelter. A wounded soldier cries out for help behind a row of beer coolers. A little girl shot by mistake is delivered to her enemies in order to save her. And I don't know which is more inhuman, the alien beings that created this new world, or the human being who considers, if only for an instant, pressing the green button. Three large clumps of stationary dots hover on the right side of the screen. The sleeping. A dozen isolated individuals on the periphery. Sentries. Two in the middle, mine and Jumbo's neck, his in my mouth. Another three or four very close, on the same floor, the sick and injured. One floor down, the ICU, where only one green sphere glows. So, barracks, observation posts, hospital. A couple of the sentry dots are manning the magazine building. I won't have to guess which two. I'll know in a few minutes. Come on, Razor, let's go. I've got one last promise to keep. Watching the gusher pour from the broken pipe. Chapter 69.
Do you pray? Razor asked me after an exhausting night of chase ball while he packed up the game board in pieces.
I shook my head. Do you?
Damn right I do.
Nodding his head emphatically.
No atheists in foxholes.
My father was one.
A foxhole?
An atheist.
I know that, Ringer.
How did you know my father was an atheist?